This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Good evening. This is The Informer and I'm Claudine Cheong. Tonight we'll hear about Anzac Day commemorations of LGBTI military personnel and talk about issues that remain for LGBTI members of the Defence Forces. You're on The Informer on Joy 94.9. Yesterday was Anzac Day, when Australians and New Zealanders remember our country's participation in military engagements around the world. And as they've done for a few years now, LGBTI military personnel and veterans celebrated the day by laying rainbow wreaths at war memorials around the country. These commemorations are organised by DEFTLIST, the Defence LGBTI Information Service. And we've got Stuart Martin from DEFTLIST in the studio now. Thanks for joining us, Stuart.
Thank you for the opportunity, Claudine.
Well, to start off, tell us a bit about DEFTLIST. What does it do?
DEFTLIST is an organisation for current serving personnel, and it's ex-serving personnel. It's an organisation that supports them while serving, has a footprint into providing advice and information to defence on how to support its own LGBTI personnel, as well as supporting members who've left military, as well as public servants, including that group. We try to have a mix between helping people whose lives are, day-to-day serving and the issues they may have, and that can be just providing advice and information and support about coming out in your service, in your unit, to bigger picture stuff. You know, we've worked very closely with Defence in developing responses to their transgender policy. We have a social aspect as well. We try to do lots of social events, and we march in Mardi Gras in uniform, which is a great event to be able to take part in. We also, this year we're running our second Military Pride Ball. We run social events during the year for members as well.
And is it represented around the country, in every major cities and other...
Yes, we coalesce predominantly around where the military service is. So each state will have a group organising for issues and events in that state. We also have a national coordination, so things like Military Pride Ball, the Anzac Day events we've recently run, the Mardi Gras, they have a national focus. We also then, the local coordinators will organise things on the local level. So that might be the Christmas get-together, or we'll have a get-together when postings come out. So you go to a new base and you immediately have someone from the LGBTI on that base who can welcome you and say, hey, here's a support network for you.
So that would be for people who are openly out.
Mm-hmm.
What's that? Do you know how difficult that is these days to come out?
I think it's still very difficult. If I was a young private posted into an infantry platoon or in a tank regiment, unless you're very confident about yourself, it is difficult. And I think it's the same as if you were joining a new company. The issues about coming out and when you come out and who you come out to, they take time. Even in my own career, I've always had the philosophy of joining a new organisation, you want people to get to know you professionally. You don't get to go to work for a company because you want to have great friends and have a great social life. Primarily, you're there to be paid, you're there to be professional, and you want people to respect you professionally. So if you can come from that paradigm, when you do come out, and it might be a couple of days to months or if years if you ever come out, you can at least say to the person who then has a problem with you, hang on, 2 weeks ago, you were singing my praise as a professional, and now you're bagging me because I'm gay. You have a problem here. Your organisation has a problem.
Yes.
So that's often a good way to approach it. But again, that depends on the individual and where they are in their life, what rank they are, how confident they are themselves. So it's about supporting people through that process.
And is it is there a sort of mentoring or for that, for people who might be in that earlier stages?
There is. We rely heavily on our own internal closed Facebook site. Mm-hmm. And from there, members can contact us anonymously. We have conversations. I get phone calls from members and emails saying, hey, I need some advice on this. So we all get that. Mm-hmm. We're trying to work with Defence about developing an internal ally program. Mm-hmm. And that's coming together. It just takes time. It's such a big organisation and a command and control environment at that. So that would be a much more visible process. And there are organisations out there who have an ally network that's aimed at improving professionalism and removing barriers to performance in the sense of not poor performance, you can't do your job, but issues that may affect your ability to be who you are and do the best you can be. Yep. And someone who's harassing you and is homophobic, that's not about your performance, about their performance. Yes. How do we address that? So that process, so we run parallel, but at the moment, until the ADF and public service have got that up and running, we tend to be that primary point.
Yeah. So how long has DefGLIS existed?
That's a good question. I'd say, to my knowledge, it'd be 8 to 10 years, although my involvement's not as long as that.
And I think that there was a previous organisation?
I think there was three right. previous organisations. It was always difficult pre-1992 when the Keating government basically said to the whole world and to military, it's okay to be gay mm-hmm. in the military, and you have to stop asking people this when you recruit them and stop treating them differently. That was a really big thing, because no one else in the world had done that.
Yes.
Really. Having said that, it took a while, and I'd say while is in, 10 to 12 years before Defence moved to that understanding of, yes, government means this, and there's certain things we have to do. So that's an attitudinal change that each organisation has to go through. So there was G-Force. And I knew one of the guys who was involved in that for my Air Force career. And then there was, I think, two more efforts. There was at least one informal float in Mardi Gras. And then there was one sanctioned organisation who had a presence in Mardi Gras, but they were not allowed to wear uniform.
And when was that?
In the late, I think mid to late 90s, and then again in the early 2000s, I think.
And so it's only recently that there have been marching in uniform. When was that?
I think it's 4 years ago.
All right.
This is our fourth year. Mm-hmm. And we've gone from strength to strength. There was a lot of concern some head shaking in the ADF, I think, and a lot of worried faces. Not so much about us as an organisation or the fact that we might do something inappropriate. We're very professional. Yep. As an organisation, but also the people who serve are very professional. What we were more worried about was the potential backlash from the ultra conservatives in the community and maybe even politically. But there's been no real backlash. There's been comments on websites and emails and Facebook, and there's been a couple of the Australian Christian Lobby have been quite vocal. We don't want to give them any more airtime than that. And a certain other individual who's has a battle with Defence about maintaining his commission, which I won't mention his name, so I don't want to give him any more airtime either. So there's that fringe. But we've been very fortunate in the thing that Defence has come from a perspective of saying, we're blind to ethnicity, we're mm-hmm. blind to gender, we're blind to sexuality, mm-hmm. we're blind to religion. What we want is, and what we need to attract, is the best person for the job.
Yes.
And when once you remove those particular attributes and say, when you come to work in the ADF and the public service in defence, you need to leave some of those values that, which are contrary and clash with defence's values. You need to be able to put them at the door when you walk in the door. When you put a uniform on, you're serving your country. So what's paramount is that you have to be able to live those military values. If you can't, that's when you need to leave. And that was General Morrison's famous quote. The behaviour you walk past, and we won't accept that sort of behaviour anymore. And if you can't change your attitude, then it's time to get out. So that's a very important paradigm, and defence is very clear about saying we want the best and brightest. Mm-hmm. And as you know, from the 1st of January, anyone in the military, doesn't matter what gender, can do any job as long as they can meet the inherent requirements of the job.
Yes.
And that's a major step. I only know maybe one other defence force that has that policy, and that's the Israeli Defence Force.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I've heard of... Mm. So what... before 1992, was there a screening process, or was it more informal?
Certainly a screening process. It was subtle initially. I think most people who knew they were gay and had come to terms with that knew that the military was very homophobic, mm-hmm. And so you wouldn't just join.
Yeah.
But there's always been a core group of people from pre-Alexander the Great's days
yes.
who've wanted to be in the military and don't see your sexuality as a barrier or prepared to give it up because it's something very important to them. Mm. So the first point would have been, hey, I know they're homophobic. Do I want to work with that sort of people? Yes or no? So you say, yes, I will. Then there's your initial assessment day with recruiting and at several points during that day, there would be a subtly pointed question, are you a homosexual?
Okay, so that was quite direct.
Yes. To which you either said yes or no. And of course, there was no other checking. What was more concerning was once you joined, military police's involvement, both in the tribe services, and they were actively trying to find gay and lesbian personnel, and if you were found, depending on your job, you were generally out the next day.
Mm.
Not about your what you give to the organisation, not the fact that you weren't doing anything illegal, or that even if you were doing it on the base,
mm-hmm.
the sheer fact that you were breaching a defence personnel instruction, that was it. So they used to hang around outside gay and lesbian nightclubs and, you know, actively look for people and then try and match that person to someone who was on a military base. In the 80s, short hair was unusual.
Right.
So you stood out potentially. Yeah. So there was, and they've been described as witch hunts.
Yep.
And they certainly did occur. I know my service, I knew some fighter pilots who were gay and nothing ever happened to them. I think if I'd came out in my job, I don't think anything would have happened. It basically came down to a unit commander wanting to do something about it or not. So in the medical branch, I think we're pretty relaxed and tolerant and wasn't an issue. Fighter pilots, lots of, you know, multi-million dollar training to fly a multi-million dollar jet aircraft. So mm-hmm. you're not going to get rid of those because of the cost and the difficulty of attracting them.
Yep.
But if you're the average Joe Blow in the military and you're a gay or a lesbian, you know, you didn't have a chance.
You're expendable.
Well, you were just more than that. You were just, from their perspective, aberrant.
Yep. Mm. Well, at least it's come some way since then.
It's come a long, long way. And I need to give Defence Command a huge pat on the back. They've turned the ADF from a very inclusively looking in organisation to one that reflects society because it serves society. One where, in my time, it was highly unusual to see someone who was Asian.
Mm.
I think I knew two, in my 6 years, two people who were Asian in the military. The role of women has changed dramatically. And that's all been driven by defence, not by politicians.
Mm.
And if you look at the current climate, even in the Abbott years of his government and even Howard era, not exactly gay friendly.
No.
ADF has managed to turn that around and run their own ship and not had any political interference. So major changes, and I think the ADF is far ahead most major corporations in Australia in the issue of how they work with LGBTI people.
This is The Informer on Joy 94.9, and we're talking to Stuart Martin from DefGLIS, the Defence LGBTI Information Service. If you've got anything to say about this, let us know by emailing onair@joy.org.au or text the studio on 0427 Joy 949. Let's just talk about Anzac Day now. So okay. I think there were rainbow wreath laying ceremonies in Melbourne, Sydney, Canberra and Brisbane.
Townsville and I think Adelaide.
Okay, so.
Yep. Eastern Seaboard, definitely.
Yes. How long has this been, this tradition been going?
This is our second year.
All right.
It would have been maybe 2 months, maybe 6 weeks before Anzac Day last year.
Mm-hmm.
And I was aware of an experience that occurred in 82 and then where some ex-service personnel who were part of a gay and lesbian group in the military wanted to lay a wreath at Melbourne Shrine of Remembrance.
Mm-hmm.
And went on Anzac Day with a wreath. And it was always done, and we've always worked from the process of being very discreet and not making a political process out of it. So they went, the five of them went to lay a wreath, and Bruce Ruxton physically stopped them and got the shrine guard to remove them from public space. Wouldn't even let them lay a wreath. So unfortunately, those five men who tried to do that are all dead.
Mm.
We never got the opportunity to right that wrong.
Yeah.
But last year, some other people tried a few years later, and a chap by the name of Max Campbell, he tried to do that as well and wasn't unsuccessful. So with that in mind, I rang the president of DefGLIS and said, hey, why don't we do something around Anzac Day? It's that day in the military where everyone pauses to think about the service of others. The fact that so many volunteers predominantly, and there's only been a tiny bit of conscription in Vietnam and a small amount in the Second World War. Every other service personnel or person has volunteered to go off to, particularly the First World War, you know, a big adventure. But, you know, by the end of 6 months of the First World War, people knew that it wasn't an adventure anymore. You know, that the casualty rates were really high. People still volunteered. So it's a significant time to pause about that sacrifice and service. And I thought, and it stuck in my mind all the time, we have a group of people who are not acknowledged, who aren't counted, who aren't welcome at Anzac Day events, partly because they had to serve in silence because the organisation found out you'd be out, partly because the social mores of the time, you didn't tell your mates.
Yeah.
And partly a lot of these people would have been dead anyway. You know, they served and died in conflict. So where was the chance for them to be remembered and honoured and respected? And, you know, so there was no opportunity for LGBTI people. And I felt that DefGLIS could fill that void and will start to fill it, I think. So Vince and I spoke over the phone for maybe an hour, and we thought, how do we approach the RSL? What are they going to say? And they're a very, very traditional organisation, and it's not just the national RSL or the state base, but also the little RSLs in the suburbs.
Mm-hmm.
How do you deal with that? How do we want to deal with that? What's going to happen? And we had some doubts, but we decided just to push ahead, and we would lay wreaths. So within 6 weeks or so, we managed to turn around and we laid wreaths in Melbourne, Sydney, Canberra and Townsville.
Mm-hmm.
We had Max Campbell was given the opportunity, the honour to lay the reef in Melbourne. And we knew we could get enough serving personnel who were in death list to support that and to be in uniform and act as an honour guard.
Yes.
Luckily, no one said you can't do this. Having said that, we didn't publicise it, nor did the other people in the past either. But we went about it in a respectful way. I think we spoke earlier about, before the interview, about ripples in the pond instead of tidal waves.
Yes.
So in conservative organisations, it's better to have a ripple effect. And that's what we've done. And it's slowly growing. Our aim is to respect and regard and honour the people who have served in the past, but also to give people an opportunity to take part today.
Well, it's great to hear that there has been all this change in just over 20 years. And there will be a full rundown on today's story and some photos from some of these ceremonies on Joy website shortly. But up next, we'll find out the latest news from Attitude in the UK with Will Stroud.
Joining us to find out what's happening in the UK, web editor of Attitude magazine, Will Stroud, joins us on the line. Good morning, Will.
Morning, James. Thanks for having me.
No worries. Now, we've talked about PrEP in the past, and there was quite a controversial decision that has been made. What's the update with that in the UK?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, as we talked about, you know, a few weeks ago, PrEP had been under review by the National Health Service here in the UK, England in particular, and they announced that they weren't going to fund a wide-scale rollout of this because they basically sort of abdicated responsibility, said it was down to sort of local HIV prevention services. Now, this sparked sort of a huge, you know, backlash at the time from HIV and sexual health charities and activists. And in the last week, what we've actually seen is NHS England have said they are going to reconsider whether they will, you know, they've sort of basically said they'll reconsider whether they consider funding a rollout. This is actually after the National AIDS Trust began sort of legal action against them in the wake of this review. They decided that they, you know, had enough of a sort of legal case to bring against the National Health Service. But, you know, I don't know the ins and outs of what those details were, whether it's down to duty of care. But yeah, obviously, it, you know, interesting that it has been put, you know, back on the agenda in the wake of, you know, pressure from sexual health charities, you know, and the community at large.
Yeah, so it's kind of a little bit of a backflip, is it?
Yeah, well, what it is, it's, you know, they've been very careful in what they've said. They said in light of, you know, the legal proceedings, they are going to reconsider whether they can do this or, you know, so basically there would be a sort of, I think, another preliminary hearing next month where they would decide whether they could put it back on the agenda, and then after that in June there would, if that went through, there would be another one to decide whether they could commission it. So
All right.
They've been, you know, very careful and not exactly a sort of firm U-turn or backing of it yet, but obviously the signs are good that this is something that could proceed, you know, further down the line.
Yeah. Well, I guess there's nothing stopping them from doing more studies to help them come to a finer decision. But something's telling me that I don't think we'll have much big news on that front anytime soon.
Absolutely.
And what's the latest coming out of Scotland in regards to this?
Well, it's, you know, interesting. You know, some figures that were, you know, released today actually, and just in terms of you know, a study that was carried out by Glasgow Caledonian University into actually sort of, they did a study of almost 700 gay men into the attitudes, you know, towards PrEP. And they discovered that actually almost half of respondents said that this is something that were available to them, they would, you know, seriously consider taking and using as a sort of a HIV prevention method. So obviously there is a, in light of that, there is a demand there. Another thing that came out of this study was the fact, however, that less than 30% had actually heard about PrEP.
Less than how many?
Less than 30%.
Right, okay. That's
I mean, in terms of, you know, awareness, obviously there is a something there, and it seems like the sort of publicity and awareness around this is, you know, building momentum more and more, but obviously still a lot to do. But
Well, yeah, it's certainly a lot more. A lot more people know about it now than they did, say, 2 years ago or 1 year ago, even.
Absolutely. Well, I think another sort of interesting dimension to this sort of whole story and issue really is actually sort of some of the attitudes that towards this obviously groundbreaking HIV prevention method. You know, rates of transmission still increasing amongst gay men here in the UK.
Yeah.
But what we're seeing is a lot of the debate centering around kind of the stigma, I guess, of, you know, that people have around safe sex and sort of some of the language, I guess, that's used about, you know, kind of people that would be using HIV prevention medication or not using things like condoms. You know, it really does has inspired, it's very polarized, actually, the opinion around this medication.
Thank you to today's guest, Stuart Martin from the Defence LGBTI Information Service. Today's producers were myself, Claudine Cheong, and Bart van der Werf. And for a podcast of today's program and our other stories, visit joy.org.au/theinformer. We'll be back tomorrow at 6:30. Up next, though, is World Wide Wave with news about the recent LGBTI murders in Bangladesh. I'm Claudine Cheong.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.